From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what does history tell us about why parents don't get their children vaccinated?
Vaccines have done their job so well that most parents today are really unaware of the severity of the diseases.
So, you think it's bone-chilling as you shovel your sidewalk? Try on this rough winter as a Michigan farmer.
His feet get really cold. He has 10 layers on the top, plus his jacket, 2 layers of long johns, and a pair of jeans.
And lessons learned from Michigan athletes at the Sochi Winter Olympics.
As in life and in figure skating, it's not about whether you fall or how you fall, but how do you respond when you get back up.
And a look back at the career of retiring Congressman John Dingell. Those stories and more today in Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and thank you so very much for joining us on this very, very cold Monday. Michigan is fourth in the nation when it comes to children not getting vaccinations because of personal or religious exemptions claimed by their parents. Vaccinations, the case for or against. Now, they've made headlines recently, but the decision whether to vaccinate or not goes way, way back. On today's show, the history of our complicated relationships with vaccines. And then as the 2014 Winter Olympics come to a close yesterday, we will get a wrap-up of just how our Michigan athletes did. But first, I am not leaving Congress. I am coming home to Michigan. With those words, John Dingell made it official. He is leaving Congress after serving more than 58 years. John Dingell was first elected in 1955 to the House seat that had been held by his late father. The 87-year-old Dearborn Democrat has gone on to carve out his own piece of American history. No one has ever served longer in the United States Congress. Joining us now is Michigan Radio political commentator Jack Lessenberry. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Why now? Why the retirement now?
Well, there's a lot of speculation on that. I had wind of this late last year, actually, and I think to some extent, like years ago, John Dingell told me that his ambition was to die on the floor of the House, as John Quincy Adams did after he was president. But I think a number of things happened. John Dingell, let it be very clear, had not lost anything mentally. I had a long two-hour conversation with him in November, December. He's the man he always was. But he's also almost 88 years old. He's had heart problems. He's had a hip transplant. He's hard of hearing. And I think getting around just wasn't as much fun anymore. And he always said that when it wasn't fun and he didn't feel he could really do the job, he would bow out. And I think that time came. The speculation, of course, is he doing this now to pave the way for his wife, Debbie Dingell, who's much younger than the congressman, almost 30 years younger, and there's been widespread speculation that she will now run for the office to succeed him.
He was giving quotes that were published over the weekend that talked about, yeah, my health's pretty good, but seems to be more than that. He finds serving in the House to be, in his words, obnoxious.
Well, I asked him last fall, I said, if you were 29 years old, that's how old he was when he was first elected to Congress, would you do this again? Would you run for Congress if it were today and you knew what you knew now? And he thought for a long time and he said, probably not. And I said, why? And he said, because it had become so polarized, so ideological, so nasty. He grew up in an era where you would campaign against each other, you would bash their issues, and then you'd go out and drink with them, or you'd go out and play golf with them, and you'd sit down after a certain amount of silliness and hash something out. He told me once he was being criticized for not being harder on the automakers about fuel emissions. And he called me that night and he said, what people don't realize is what I'm saying to the auto companies, if you do what I say, I will get you a deal that you will absolutely hate. And if you don't do what I say, they will give you a deal that will put you out of business. So he was a man who, whether you agreed with him or not, and nobody agreed with him all the time, including me, whether you agreed with him or not, he always tried to do what he thought was the right thing, according to common sense, and he knew that what goes around comes around. He knew there were going to be Democratic years and Republican years, and what John Dingell was about was the good of the Congress and the good of the country.
What does his retirement mean for his district? I know, as you say, his wife Debbie is seen as kind of a front runner for trying for that seat. But what does it mean for his district?
Well, it means I have a new congressman. They'll certainly lose seniority. Now, John Dingell himself had sort of had his wings clipped and sort of what a lot of people felt was disgraceful. Nancy Pelosi maneuvered him out of the chairmanship of his committee a few years ago.
I remember that.
And He has sort of the title chairman emeritus, but he took it in good humor. Obviously, they're going to lose a real champion. Debbie Dingell certainly has name recognition. For a while, there was some thought that she might even have to face off against his son, Christopher Dingell, in a primary. That apparently is not going to be the case. He's a judge and hasn't talked about running for Congress. There'll certainly be other people who get into this race. The one thing we know for sure is that whoever wins the Democratic primary, that's tantamount to election in this district. It is a very safe, gerrymandered Democratic district. And it's not at all like the district he started out in. We think of John Dingell as being from Dearborn, but when he was first elected, he represented just a part of Detroit. Detroit was so much larger then.
And now, of course, we know, as we've talked about, we've got this other big figure leaving Michigan politics in Democrat Carl Levin, who is not running for his Senate seat. Overall, what does this mean for Michigan's influence and toehold in Congress?
Well, of course, we're losing seniority in the House right now. That doesn't matter quite so much since Democrats are in the minority and are very unlikely to take Congress back in this next election. But certainly Carl Levin was also a giant.
Yeah.
Carl Levin, however, some people said, and there's some truth in this, was far more concerned with the Armed Services Committee, National and World Affairs, than he was with Michigan. And to be sure, there's states where you go where you had senior senators and congressmen where everything is named after them. They brought home a lot of pork barrel spending. While Dingell looked after the auto industry, neither Dingell or Levin were ever that interested in self-aggrandizement.
It isn't just here in Michigan, of course, that folks are deciding not to run again. We are seeing other lawmakers from both sides of the aisle deciding to head for the exit doors. Congressman Henry Waxman from California comes to mind. What concerns does all of that raise for you, Jack, when you think about what's ahead for Congress?
Well, what bothers me is that a lot of the people who are leaving are people like Dingell, not just because of age, but people who are more moderate. And people have been getting very weary of this sort of polarized whack-a-mole atmosphere where people don't talk to each other, where people demonize each other. I think that's a scary thing. I think that is something that causes concern. There's been other periods in American history when it was like this, too. There was a period in the 19th century where one congressman beat another one almost to death with a cane over some issue that he took offense to, and there have been people bringing guns onto the floor of Congress. There was one guy that used to bring his dogs till they made a rule you couldn't do that. So I think that there's a real concern that we're getting away from seeing the country as a united country and putting American concerns ahead of partisan concerns.
Let's circle back to John Dingell again. How did he rise to the power that he held for so long?
You know, I want to say something else about Dingell. It's something sort of unique. John Dingell first went to Congress not in 1955, but in 1933, when he was 6 years old. He walked into the House chambers holding the hand of his father, also named John Dingell, who'd just been elected, part of that wave of New Deal Democrats, came in with Franklin D. Roosevelt. He told me that is still etched in his memory. He thought the doors to Congress were the biggest doors he'd ever seen. And pretty much he spent his life there. He was a page. He was an elevator operator. He was a page on the floor of the Congress when Franklin D. Roosevelt made his famous Day of Infamy speech declaring war on Japan after Pearl Harbor. He left. He was a lawyer in Detroit for a brief while. He served in World War II, one of only two surviving congressmen who did that. And then, of course, when his dad died of tuberculosis, he ran in a special election for his seat. But partly he rose through seniority system, and partly because he just became a bulldog on issues. People knew his word could be trusted, and he was also a powerful, he was a very big man. We think of him as being kind of infirm now, but he was something like 6 feet five. They used to call him the truck. Very big man, very big and intimidating physically, but he also knew what he knew, and he knew how to count votes. I know a man who years ago was thinking about running for office against a friend of Congressman Dingell's, and Congressman Dingell called him in and very good-naturedly informed him that if he did that, he would be totally destroyed politically for life. John Dingell said, if you watch the House of Cards, John Dingell was sort of like a non-corrupt, non-evil Frank Underwood. He knew how to get it done,
yeah.
and he certainly did, but he was always, always respected. Now, there are people in Congress today who've been there. Of course, no one's been there as long as he, who mentally shouldn't be there, and they can't do the job anymore. Nobody said that of John Dingell. John Dingell chose when to leave, and he didn't leave because he couldn't do the job intellectually. I think that we need to make that very clear.
Can you give us a sense, Jack, what do you think history will say about John Dingell's time in Congress?
I think they'll say that he was a man primarily of Michigan, a man of the auto industry, a man who sometimes may have moved a little too late to embrace things like fuel emission standards and environmental standards, but who was capable of learning, of moving on the job. He was somebody who people could do business with. He was a man who was respected. And in his leaving today, I have not heard a single person say, well, it was past time. We wish he'd left a long time ago. They recognize that, you know, we all have a biological clock, and it was time for him to do this. If anything, they respect the fact that he did this now. But there's a lot of sadness, and that includes among some Republicans who often voted very differently from he.
We know that candidates for Congress have till April 22nd to get at least 1,000 petition signatures to get on that ballot for the August 5th primary. Does anyone come to mind other than Debbie Dingell that would have a shot at that race?
Frankly, I don't know. There'll certainly be some other people entering that race. I mean, John Dingell has represented that district forever. I mean, he's been there forever. He hasn't had any kind of a real challenge since they combined two districts and Michigan lost population about 12 years ago, and he was thrown into a district with Lynn Rivers, from a Democrat from Ann Arbor, and she insisted on taking on John Dingell. She won Ann Arbor handily, but in Wayne County and Monroe County, she was obliterated. Dingell beat her about 3-2 in the primary. He's never had the only time, the other time he had a challenge and he was not expected to survive it was early on, because he stood up for the civil rights bill, and he had a district, this was 1964, he had a district that was largely working class, blue collar, not especially enlightened white voters, and the Wall Street Journal thought he had virtually no chance to win the primary, but win the primary he did. So again, the idea of this district without Dingell is kind of like the idea of Ann Arbor without Zingerman's or Ann Arbor without the University of Michigan. And it may take a few days before things settle out, but I would guess that no matter what happens, whether Mrs. Dingell gets in there or not, it will be a contested primary.
Michigan Radio political commentator Jack Lessenberry. Always a pleasure, Jack. Thank you.
Same here.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, heaven knows we have had a lot to grumble about as this long, cold, snowy winter drags on and on. Sidewalks and driveways to shovel. Grueling, slow freeway commutes. But take a moment and let's try on winter from the perspective of the hardworking Michigan dairy farmer. Winter has a whole different feel when you're hauling yourself out to the barn to milk and feed your herd in the wee hours of the morning. Karen Curry knows this all too well. Karen's a dairy farmer near East Howis in Iosco County. Now, Karen, while most of us are crabbing because we have to fire up the snow thrower again, tell us, what has this winter been like for you on your dairy farm?
Oh, my gosh. An absolute nightmare as far as, like, extra work. But amazingly, the cattle have been awesome. You know, the guys go out early in the morning. The first thing they have to do is move the snow out of the way so that you can get the tractors going and you can feed the cows. So, I mean, when you wake up to, like, you know, 6-8 inches of snow on the ground and you have to do all of your snow removal before you can even start your morning chores, it's very physically exhausting.
So that just adds more time that you have to get out there to get this.
Oh, it does. Everything takes so much longer in the winter. You know, the cows don't want to move as well, so it's extra money and time with our people who are milking the cows and moving the cows around. You know, you have extra feed that you're buying all winter long, extra straw that you're using all winter long, extra fuel in moving the snow all winter long. It's exhausting, but at the same time, it's very expensive.
Now, we have heard it said snow is never a bad thing for farmers, that farmers are always glad for anything that boosts soil moisture.
Well, the thing that's hurt us in the last few years is not having that snow cover on the alfalfa fields. So what happens is you constantly have a thaw and you have water running through your fields, and that actually kills out your alfalfa. So that's, I think, why we like to have that snow cover on the fields. For one thing, just to protect those alfalfa plants that are dormant. And then, yeah, the extra moisture, I mean, that's always a good thing, as long as we get a decent spring that's not all wet, too. And then you have water on top of water, and we're planting in June, like we did last year.
Okay. Do you think, Karen, that this tough winter might set you and other dairy farmers on the path to a good year? I know it a lot depends on what Mother Nature serves up in the spring and the summer.
From a milk price outlook, I think 2014 is going to be one of the highest. Being that it's been so cold, the animals have ate a lot more feed. So, I mean, we're going to pretty much be wiped out of feed by harvest time in June is when we get, you know, our first crop off of alfalfa. And I know a lot of other farms right now that are looking for supplemental feed. In this cold weather, there's also a lot of cows that they're just not making it. They have to get culled early. So you have a lot of animals that are going to market. So that, you know, that milk production isn't there. You have California that's in a drought right now. So they're not producing the milk like they should be.
When it is so incredibly cold, like when we've been in the grip of that polar vortex, what is it that gets you out there no matter how cold it is and how many layers of clothes you have to wear and what you have to face? What gets you out there?
You know that you have animals to take care of. I mean, and being a farm kid, my husband's a farm kid, you have that responsibility. And that is all that you think about. I mean, that's your livelihood. You have to make sure that they survive so that they will take care of you and that you survive.
Karen Curry is a dairy farmer in near East Tawas in Iosco County. Karen, thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
Well, winter doesn't just mean freezing temperatures. It's also a time when a lot of us are likely to get sick. And that kind of leads to my next question. Do you vaccinate your children? It seems for more and more Michigan parents, the answer is no. When it comes to children not being vaccinated because their parents claim some personal or religious exemption, Michigan is number 4 in the nation. But resistance to vaccinations didn't just start with Jenny McCarthy or that study by British Dr. Andrew Wakefield that alleged a link between vaccines and autism, a study, by the way, that has since been discredited as being based on faulty science. But it goes back long before that. Gender and medical historian Jacqueline Antonovich has studied and written about the history of our complicated relationship with vaccinations. Now, Jacqueline, you recently wrote in the blog nursingcleo.org about this topic, and it was pretty personal for you. You got clobbered with whooping cough?
I did, actually. It was quite ironic. I found someone who studies sort of these historic diseases to actually come down with what I called an Oregon Trail disease, if you're familiar with that childhood game. Yeah.
And there you were. And this is not something to take lightly. I guess it isn't just lying around and coughing.
No, actually, it was quite severe. I was on 5 different medications. I bruised a rib. I strained some mm-hmm. muscles in my neck. And I was actually quarantined by my doctor for a few days. So it's not pleasant. And actually, my husband also came down with it for a few days.
Wonderful. So. Well, you pose a very good question in the piece that you wrote for nursingcleo.org, and that is, how did a disease that was basically wiped out in the 1970s wind up infecting you and your husband in 2014?
Well, it's a very complicated question, and as you alluded to, I think a lot of this sort of current trend or resurgence that we're seeing in whooping cough is a combination of the study from Andrew Wakefield that really sort of prompted suspicion about all vaccines, not just the MMR vaccine mm-hmm. that he was looking at. But also pertussis, the vaccine wears off over time. So it's not as effective. You know, you need to get a booster if you haven't had one in a few years, which was the case for me. It's a good idea to go in and speak with your doctor and get one, especially if you're pregnant. They're recommending now to get one if you're pregnant.
But what we're seeing and looking at incidents around the country is there's an increase. And how much of that do you think is behind people choosing to say no to vaccines?
Well, I think that is a significant factor in the increase in vaccines. We can see all over the country, as you mentioned, there's some pretty scary statistics mm-hmm. For parents not vaccinating their children. In California, Colorado, and unfortunately in Michigan as well, in Washington, we're seeing some really scary numbers that are affecting what public health officials call herd immunity.
And talk about the importance of that, because it is important for those who are getting their kids vaccinated or getting their vaccines themselves as they go through life
to understand that they can be impacted by those who choose to not do it.
Absolutely. So it's not just about protecting yourself and protecting your family. It's really about protecting the community. And so herd immunity is a term that public health officials use. And what it means is when a critical portion of the community is immunized against a contagious disease, most members of the community are protected against the disease because there's little opportunity for an outbreak. And even those who are not eligible for certain vaccines, like infants, mm-hmm. The elderly, pregnant women, or even immunocompromised individuals, they're also protected because contagious disease is – the disease is minimized. And the required percentage of vaccinations to ensure herd immunity, it varies by disease. But for pertussis – a disease that Michigan has been grappling with, it's between 93 and 95%. So even if a small number of children aren't vaccinated, it can lower the level for herd immunity that's needed.
And so knowing that Michigan is fourth in the nation in parents choosing to say no to vaccines, can we track that with that study from Wakefield? Did that resistance kind of take root and start resurging at that study and then Jenny McCarthy piling in with her book and her story?
Right. Yeah. I think we actually can. And, you know, Wakefield's finding, as you mentioned, really caught attention of these autism advocacy groups and Jenny McCarthy. But I think the popularity stems from the fact that, you know, with autism, it offers a tangible explanation for like this really complex issue of autism. And I think planting that seed of doubt really sort of influenced a lot of parents to sort of be skeptical of all vaccinations. But to be fair, a lot of parents are just concerned about the amount of vaccines that their children mm-hmm. are getting, not just the MMR vaccine. And it can be pretty scary for new parents when they find out just how many vaccines their children are supposed to get. And I would add that sort of in an age where public health campaigns really stress patient advocacy, it's understandable that parents want to be strong advocates for their children. In this case, however, the advocacy is based on flawed science. So
parents are feeling either they do believe there's some dark side to vaccines or they don't want to put their children through so many vaccines. Is there something even deeper? Does this distrust of vaccinations reflect other issues of distrust, for example, distrust in the government?
Well, absolutely. And as a historian, this is actually a question that I'm really interested in. And suspicions of vaccines are nothing new. Our country has a long history of anti-vaccination and anti-inoculation campaigns that we can actually trace back to colonial America. In 1721, for example, there was a terrible smallpox epidemic in Boston where 844 people died. But the famous Reverend Cotton Mather, whom you mm-hmm. may have heard of or learned mm-hmm. about in school,
yeah.
He was this huge advocate for smallpox inoculation, which is really different than a modern-day vaccination. But many other people in the Boston community, including physicians, disagreed with Mather, and they feared that the inoculations would actually spread the disease and kill more people. And actually, the controversy was so intense that at one point, an anti-inoculation protester threw a lighted bomb through the window of Cotton Mather's house. So this debate has always been really intense. And much later in the first decade of the 20th century, a lot of anxiety and uncertainty existed surrounding the advent of germ theory, new scientific medicine, and the subsequent vaccinations that came along with that.
And at the same time, you had the flu epidemic
right.
that raged around the world.
Absolutely. And so much of this concern had to do with the safety, but also, as you mentioned, a lot of the debate centered on suspicions surrounding compulsory vaccination laws. Much of the debate centered on individual rights versus a public good. Does the state have the right to penalize you if you refuse a vaccination? And in 1905, the Supreme Court decided in Jacobson v. Math that in Massachusetts' case, the state actually could enact compulsory laws.
So the greater good outweighs my right to say you can't make me have a vaccination.
Right. In the case of a disease like smallpox, mm-hmm. yes. And certainly diseases like, you know, HPV and all that are completely different
yes.
cases and don't apply to that particular case. But I will add that throughout the 20th century, there have been many anti-vaccination groups, and actually, like the current crop, they've often used media and popular culture to advocate for their cause. They've circulated their ideas through posters, newspapers, and even songs. There's actually an anti-vaccination hymn out there.
I'm talking with gender and medicine historian Jacqueline Antonovich, who's been studying the history of our relationship with vaccinations. And Jackie, I grew up in the 1950s. I remember being taken to the local school, being given a little paper cup with a sugar cube with that Salk polio vaccine. I remember being intensely relieved that it wasn't a shot. I remember as a little child.
Right.
I dare say my parents and others were absolutely thrilled to have something that would liberate them from the worry of their kids contracting polio. It was such a specter in the first half of the 20th century, and now we don't think about it. Has there been a sense that almost vaccines have worked too well to eradicate disease, so people feel, well, I don't need to have my child vaccinated? Is it almost like a victim of its own success?
Absolutely. I actually think that this latest anti-vaccination, sort of the safety that we feel, is sort of an ignorance of our own past. We sort of forget, you know, how devastating polio was. And polio was actually really sort of catalyzed people to really support vaccinations, because now it wasn't just the sick or the elderly, it was your children that were being affected by polio.
You could go to the lake for a summer outing, and then a week later you have a child with polio.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. And so I think
or a president in case of FDR.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I think vaccines have done their job so well that most parents today are really unaware of the severity of the diseases their children are being protected against.
What do you see behind the implications, whether they're philosophical or what it is, about parents not trusting their pediatrician or not trusting public health experts, but they'll trust Jenny McCarthy?
Right. So as late as the 1980s, we also had this sort of new component to the anti-vaccination feelings. There were several documentaries and movies books that were published questioning the risk-benefit analysis of the pertussis vaccine. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of this sort of comes out of this time in the 1980s where we started to really question the expertise of our doctors. You know, we really used to sort of automatically defer to their expertise. And I think the self-help movement, and we could even point to the feminist health movement of the 1970s, really pushed us to question this automatic authority, which was great in many cases. But in this particular case, not so much.
Interesting. So what we're seeing then as a result of this are increasing rates of diseases that were once literally on the back shelf that we didn't have to think about.
Absolutely. A few years ago, of course, California had a really horrible pertussis outbreak where 9 infants died. And also we've been seeing little pockets of measles outbreaks in Texas and in California. So, and these are outbreaks that we haven't really been seeing lately. So it's a bit troubling.
And you are a mother as well as a historian. Mm-hmm. What do you say when you dialogue with parents who say, no, I'm not going to have my child vaccinated?
Well, I mean, as you probably know, it's a really contentious debate, right? And
yes,
you always want to respect people's opinions. I just try and present the facts. I tell them that I vaccinate my children. All of the physician friends that I have vaccinate their children. And I just really try, and I think this is why history is important. We try and stress this in the blog project Nursing Cleo, connecting sort of this, our collective historical memory to these present day issues is vital in sort of giving us some perspective. We certainly don't want polio to reemerge as a disease in the United States. But also the measles, we often think of the measles as just a rash and a fever, but it can be very debilitating. And I think that we have a short sort of memory about these things.
So what's the main lesson that parents in 2014 can learn from history when it comes to approaching vaccinations?
I would advise parents to just really consider, talk to their doctors and consider that side effects are very minimal, and we can't take for granted the protections that modern day vaccines have brought us. And I really think that this is an opportunity for parents to really have an open dialogue with their physicians, with their family physicians.
Jackie Antonovich is a gender and medicine historian working on her PhD in history at the University of Michigan, and she's the executive editor of the collaborative blog project NursingCleo.org. Thanks for talking with us today, and glad you've recovered from your whooping cough.
Thank you very much. This is a pleasure.
Welcome back to Stateside. The 2014 Winter Olympics are now in the record books. The Olympic flame has been extinguished. Athletes and reporters are packed up and heading home from Sochi. And that includes NPR's Sonari Glinton, who joins us now from Sochi. Hello, Sonari.
Hey, Cindy. How you doing?
Doing well. You know, Sonari, there were so many less than wonderful reports that came out of Sochi at the beginning of the Olympics, with the unfinished hotel rooms and the suspicious looking yellow water coming out of taps and computers and smartphones reportedly being hacked, all of that. And overlaying that was the threat of terrorists. I'm wondering, how did all of those hashtag Sochi fail tweets square with your actual experience in Sochi?
You know, I think it got a lot more attention because, you know, there were no games, there was no news. So all reporters had to do was grouse, you know? And so that kind of got into the firmament. I mean, there were definitely some problems. But the big things, when you talk to an athlete, when you talk to the coaches about the venues and where they were staying, it was universally praised by the athletes. There was a little problems with snow in the mountains, but the ice was great at all of the arenas. The athletes' lodgings were great. And that's sort of a sign of sort of where the priorities were for Putin and the people in charge of the games. The athletes first, reporters down at the bottom.
Fair enough. You know, we did keep hearing that drumbeat of terrorism threat. And that went on for weeks leading up to the Olympics. Sonara, do you think the media overdid the terrorism stories?
Well, I wonder if, you know, if something had happened, right, we would have, you know, it's better safe than sorry, I think. Our friends to the north did not seem to have this sort of fervor about terrorism. So there were a lot more Canadians who showed up at these games than Americans. So there were the Russians and the Canadians were the two large groups of people. There also weren't a lot of international travelers who ended up coming here. We don't know what the threat assessments were, but I'm very happy that I didn't have to report on anything more than Shani Davis or the skaters from Michigan.
I would agree with that. And something else, Sonari, before the games, we heard a lot of criticism, especially from the athletes, about Russia's anti-gay laws with the fines for speaking out on behalf of gay rights or for saying gay relationships are equal to heterosexual relationships in front of minors. I saw one place where an Australian snowboarder declared in a pre-Olympics interview she was going to, quote, rip on President Putin's, shall we say, behind after competing. But then competitions began. Things got real quiet and muted on that front. Why do you think that was?
Because at the end of the day, it seems as if the Olympics are about competition. And at the end of the day, the athletes aren't politicians. They're athletes. One of the few people who consistently spoke out was Ashley Wagner, who is an American ice skater. And she came in the top 10 for the Americans. And she sort of consistently talked about it. But none of the other athletes seemed to, I mean, there are so many things to focus on that they couldn't focus on politics.
That's true, and they had medals to compete for. We're speaking with NPR's Sonari Glinton, who is joining us from Sochi as he gets ready to head home after the Winter Olympics. So let's talk, if we can, about some of the Michigan athletes who made their way to Sochi. There were a lot of them. I'm just wondering, Sonari, whose thrill of victory, agony of defeat stories grabbed you the most?
All right, so for two Michiganders, there is Charlie White and Merrill Davis, who compete or who train in Michigan, and Patrick Chan, who is a Canadian but also trains in the Detroit area, and Jeremy Abbott. Charlie White and Merrill Davis, they won gold in ice dancing. They're an incredible delight to see. So that was really interesting. Patrick Chan, who ended up getting second place, he was sort of favored to get the gold. And then finally, Jeremy Abbott said something that I thought was interesting. He moved to Michigan to change up his training schedule, and he ended up doing pretty poorly. But it's really interesting because he talked a lot about how hard it is to be a figure skater and how much bullying there is. And I just thought that was a really fascinating thing that an athlete showed, you know, his frustration.
When you think about it, I know in ice dancing, it was 15 of the 20 teams train in the Metro Detroit area between Novaya, Canton, and the Detroit Skate Club in Bloomfield Hills. And I do think a lot of people's hearts were captured by men's figure skater Jeremy Abbott when he did that wipeout and crashed into the wall, lay there for what seemed like forever, and then got up and nailed his routine, even though he was clearly in pain. What was cool to watch, tell me what it was like to be there, was hearing the Russian crowd cheering him on. He said that's what got him up and on, back on his feet.
Yeah, I was sitting with a group of grizzled figure skating reporters, and the reporter next to me said that she had been covering figure skating for more than 24 years, and she hadn't seen a fall quite that bad. And when you were there, I mean, I inhaled. I wasn't that far away from him. You know, he was down at our side of the rink, and I talked to him moments after that, and you could just see the pain. Not the pain of having hurt himself, but the pain of how much he had worked. I mean, he had seen, he'd been seeing a sports psychologist because he had done poorly in 2010. He had worked really hard to sort of, you know, as in life and in figure skating, it's not about whether you fall or how you fall, but how do you respond when you get back up? And that was one of the more inspirational moments, because he realized probably then that he wasn't going to win, that he wasn't going to get on the podium, but he had to finish not only for himself, but for his team and for the crowd that was out there. And I was really inspired by him.
Sonari, give us your impressions of the everyday, you know, guy and gal on the street Russians that you were able to encounter.
It's really funny. As you know, but maybe our listeners don't, I'm an African-American man, and there are not a lot of them in Russia. So as I would walk to the along the Black Sea, it often would be hard for me, because people would stop and ask me to take my photo.
Oh, really?
Yes. So that was pretty funny. Everyone was kind. It's interesting, because you know, the idea of customer service, the way we think of customer service, hasn't been around that long because of the Soviet era here. And so there's a lot of adjustments to sort of, you know, how to deal with people as customers, even now, you know, 20 years hence. And so 25 years hence. So there was a lot of that going on, which is, you know, really people trying really hard to be open and hospitable. But what was really funny was how you could sense that people wanted people to think well of Russia. Maybe not of the government, but of the Russian people. And, you know, last night at the, you know, all the journalists and a bunch of the Russian volunteers go to a karaoke bar that's near our hotel. And, you know, after weeks of hanging out with these people, you know, their English gets better. And they just say, we hope that you understand a little bit more about Russia, that it's not what, one of the volunteers said to me, we're not all Putin. And I thought that was a really, that's exactly the way I think people encounter me.
NPR's Sonari Glinton checking in from Sochi, Russia. Thanks so much, Sonari.
It's always a pleasure.
Michael Lee is a professional mime and physical acting coach. He's worked with 10 of the 24 figure skating ice dance teams at the Winter Olympics, and that includes Michigan natives Merrill Davis and Charlie Gold, who won that historic gold medal for America this year in ice dance. And he works with Tessa Virtue and Scott Moyer of Canada, the silver medalist who train in Canton. Lee says he helps the skaters become performers by teaching them how to animate their bodies. He himself learned miming from the late Marcel Marceau, an acclaimed French mime. Stateside's Mercedes Mejia sat down with Lee and asked him to explain the physical acting techniques that he shows the ice dancers. He says, among other things, it's all about breath, body movement, and emotion.
I'm Michael Lee. First thing is that I'm a mime. I'm a mime actor, I'm a mime director, I'm a mime coach. Sometimes it's called physical acting, which is exactly what mime is. What I do when I work with the ice dancers, especially first, right away, is in the studio, I teach them how to take their body that is normal and maybe just in a relaxed position, and for instance, just standing or sitting, and to animate it. And that's what we call suspension. And the suspension then is like a thread going up and a thread going down. and it's a thread going out one arm and out the other. It's this, these threads that are, we use counterpoint, and that's kind of one of the second very important things that we use is counterpoint. So there's always a movement going in two different directions. Imagine if anybody's put on skates and went around the ice, of course, if they've never skated before, they're going to be falling down a lot. Well, these are professional skaters, and they move, and they move beautifully, but at the beginning, they don't move as if they're performing. And that's what I'm about, is so they get this suspension, which invites us in to watch. They find out, wow, they're moving some way that they never have. Most of the time, the men especially will puff out their chest too much. The women will arch their back too much. Both will jut out their jaw in these kind of artificial, it's like artificial acting. They think they're acting, but they'll do this, but I call their angst face, and they'll skate around like this, and they pretend they're acting, but they're just making this angst face. And so when they start to breathe, and they say, well, inhaling is joy, and exhaling is sorrow, and inhaling is hope, and exhaling is disappointment. And all these things then connect to different emotions that they're trying to portray. So I give them homework. And I go do 2 minutes of this. Just breathe every movement. Like when they touch each other's face, or they touch their own, I say, don't actually touch the skin, but caress the space. And they reach toward each other, and they fill up the space between them with emotion.
About a year ago, in response to what they call palpable hostility towards women, a group of students at Michigan Tech began publishing a newspaper they call Beyond the Glass Ceiling. We wondered what this says about the campus culture and attitudes towards women at the campus in Houghton in the Upper Peninsula, and what those who write in Beyond the Glass Ceiling are trying to say to their fellow students as well as faculty and school administrators. I'm joined now by Katie Snyder. She's a PhD candidate in rhetoric and technical communication at Michigan Tech. Katie, just why was this newspaper needed?
Well, you know, the university has done a lot over the years to address the gender imbalance and campus culture, but we really felt like we needed to provide a forum for students to talk about this issue and to have their say.
Now, there have been six issues of Beyond the Glass Ceiling, correct? So it's been out not quite a year, and I was wondering, is there a difference in the way students receive the paper at the outset versus now? Has there been some progress?
that little laugh
is telling, Katie Snyder.
We initially received some good feedback from a few students and from people in administration. But the most recent edition, you know, papers have been thrown in the garbage. We've received negative feedback from several female students who are saying we're creating a problem where one doesn't exist. So the feedback is, we don't get a lot of feedback, to be honest, but I would say it's not trending positive at this point.
You've actually, Katie, had some men write pieces for the paper. As I looked through, they're all online, so I was looking at them, and I saw guys writing. What have their messages been?
I mean, there are male and female students alike who perceive the sexism problem on campus, because sexism is not just a problem for women, but it limits men as well. So one student was talking about this issue in terms of how gender stereotypes are limiting for men and women. I think that was in one of the first or second issues.
Yeah.
And so that was a thoughtful piece and useful, I think.
What are you hoping through your writing and through working on Beyond the Glass Ceiling and ultimately your dissertation, how are you hoping to affect the conversation about sexism?
Well, one thing on Michigan Tech's campus is just to have a conversation, because there's been very little, at least in the last 5 years, you know, in a broad way, there's been very little conversation about sexism. So it's to open up that debate, you know, for students. And, you know, the other thing is that we do see a lot at stake here, that engineering and the sciences, if there's only a limited part of the population involved, it's mainly men, then there's so many perspectives that are being left out. And we have some really serious problems to address in this world, you know, with housing and transportation and water and the environment. And the STEM fields address those, and I think we really limit ourselves when we leave out women and minorities from this field.
But I bet as you and the other students are putting out these editions of Beyond the Glass Ceiling and trying to, as you say, get a conversation started on the Michigan Tech campus, and then you have women slamming you saying you're creating trouble where none exists. So sometimes you feel like Don Quixote tilting at that windmill.
Yeah, it does become difficult to talk about a problem that has in many ways become kind of subtle. You know, I mean, the statistics are obvious, but the ways that it's enacted are subtle. And women, you know, women on tech campus and their defense, certainly they're just trying to get through. You know, they're trying to do something that they care about, and they're trying to figure out a way to do that. And they don't have a lot of tools, so to speak, in their favor. So we're hoping that we can convince them to try and see from a different perspective, you know, for everyone's benefit.
Katie Snyder is one of the Michigan Tech University students who's behind the campus newspaper Beyond the Glass Ceiling, trying to change the conversation and get a conversation started about sexism on the campus at Michigan Tech. Katie, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattlesey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, and Claire Tenniskitter. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Stay warm, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.